Well, welcome to Heart Team, a new multimedia series from medical news site HCP Live. I'm Dr. Mike Farku, the Director of Clinical Trials at the Peter Munk Cardiac Center and Vice Chair of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Joining me once again is my co-host, Dr. Jorge Plutsky. Jorge, welcome.
Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm the Director of Preventive Cardiology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and looking forward to continuing our discussion today.
Well, today's episode will renew the state of heart disease and heart disease management and research in women. And we'll be joined by our friend, Dr. Martha Galati, who is Director of Preventive Cardiology, Associate Director of the Barbara Streisand Women's Heart Center, and Associate Director of Preventive and Cardiac Rehabilitation at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Martha, welcome to Heart Team.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So Martha, tell us, what are the main challenges in 2022 facing clinicians when we manage women's heart health? Where have we come and where are we heading?
So we've definitely come a long way. I think when I started, as a fellow in my early part of my career, I would say that, we didn't have women in a lot of trials. We didn't know a lot of information. The only thing we knew was our statistics. We knew that women did worse. We knew that, for just a simple example, the common things being common after a heart attack, women had worse outcomes, and we did everything. We didn't follow our guidelines. We didn't take the patients to the women patients to the cath lab fast enough. We didn't give them thrombolytics fast enough or open their arteries fast enough. We didn't discharge them with guideline-directed care. And ultimately, that meant that women had worse outcomes. Now, we've been talking about that, though, for more than two decades. And I will tell you that those patterns are still persistent today. They're better, but there is still a sex gap in outcomes. And that's partly because we're still learning about women, because, we were in the early stages of even understanding them since we've only included them in clinical trials in these last few decades. And I think there's also, we're learning about our own bias in care and how we approach women and approach their symptoms. So I think we're doing better, but we still have a long way to go.
What do you see, Martha? Can I jump in as the opportunities for changing that? I mean, how do we, not only continue to change, but accelerate the process of change? I mean, wave your magic wand. What are the things you would have as changes within our cardiology community?
I think one thing that we can do is, we can use different prompts or artificial intelligence to help improve care. Simple examples of when you use the electronic health record to guide early care for potential myocardial infarction has shown that when you put those things into our electronic records, we definitely narrow the gap in care for men between women and men. So you harnessing the power of electronic health records using artificial intelligence, we shouldn't be scared of that. We should be welcoming it if it prompts us to do something that we normally wouldn't. I think that's at least one thing that we can do it. I think also when we're looking at trials, I think that we should be better than just saying we need to hold investigators accountable when they do their trials. Why is there not the population prevalence percentage of women in those trials? We had a trial recently at ESC that had 0%
women. Not good.
And you're like, why? Because this was a coronary artery disease study, another study with 0% women included. Yeah. So we actually should really be asking, why are those studies on the big stage? Why are they in our big journals? We should really push that what we want in our journals is also what looks like our population, the people that we're caring for. And I think if we change those things, people will respond. If you're doing a study, for example, and you're not going to get paid unless you get an exact number of men and women, mm-hmm. Guess what? The investigators will then find them. We know that they find people for the study when the money's on the line. So I think those are things we can do.
Martha, we've looked at this. And as with NIH grants, we always have to fill out a table what our target enrollment is, and we've always say 50% women, yet at best we do about 70%, 30% women, 70% men, and we've never been held accountable for that. So that's federal funding, which I think is a place to start. One of the things we've realized as we try to target women in our trials of ischemic heart disease is they're not willing to enter a trial because of the rigor of follow-up. They have other responsibilities, often caregiver to the family, even to some grandchildren and so on, and their willingness to participate. We haven't made it convenient for women to participate in clinical trials. And I think that's one of the major obstacles, as opposed to us trying to go out and recruit women. I think we make that a priority, but we're just not successful at it. Any insights there?
Well, I agree with you. It is hard. And I think for women particularly, it's harder for them to come for repeated visits. But I will say, you know, being involved in women-only studies, like right now, the Warrior study in our hospital, I'm the PI of that. It's all women and we don't seem to be having a problem getting them. But I do agree that there is studies that just make it impossible for women to necessarily participate at the levels we want. I think where we've been really successful is our pragmatic studies, the studies where people could enroll in line, where they could do it, the follow-up online. And during COVID, we learned, you know, those studies that were put sign up online and we're going to do everything at the comfort of your home. Guess what? Those studies, we actually got more women than men to participate. So women want to be part of trials, but we also have to think about how will they come? What will make it easier for them? And I think this is true for both men and women. We should think about trials in a different way for our follow-up. Do we really need them to come in every time? Is there a way to make it easier for them?
Right. Yeah, great point. Martha, on the presentation of ischemic heart disease, you know, we've been always taught, and we've used this buzzword atypical, and women don't present in the same way. But more recent data has suggested that women present in similar ways to men, and it's maybe the recognition of these symptoms or our perception of our patients having symptoms that leads to delays. What are your thoughts about that? Do you believe the data from trials like Hermes that have shown that really presentation is quite similar?
I think, you know, this Hermes and other data like from the high stakes group have shown us that, you know, there is differences. Let me be truthful. There's differences between men and women and how they'll present. But in terms of saying the words chest pain, 90% of women and 90% of men do use the words chest pain. Hermes, you know, they were really smart. They used cardiolinguistics or artificial intelligence. Basically, they listened in to the conversation and the computer recorded every time they heard chest pain. So there's no bias because it's just when I heard those words, it said, I heard it. And that group showed that, you know, again, 90% of women and 90% of men reported that. Similarly, the high stakes group where they recorded it from the patients that went on to have a myocardial infarction, they show this really beautiful image that looks like a bullseye that actually more women than men reported what we used to call typical symptoms of ischemia. And then the Virgo study of young men and young women, where we didn't know as much about younger people. So under the age of 55, they found the same thing. 90% of women reported chest pain, as did men. The difference between women versus men, though, is women are more likely to use more descriptors. They're more likely to present with three or more additional symptoms. And so maybe chest pain they mention, but it's not their biggest issue. They're reporting other symptoms that are present and more concerning to them. But when someone is in the emergency room or in our offices, and if there's somebody that you identify could be at risk, we need to be thinking of them as patients that are at risk for heart disease in the same way that we do for men. I think, you know, with men, we often, you know, I always say that a man will come in with they've used one of those mechanisms to put in a nail that goes through their hand and somehow they get an EKG. They're there. But
absolutely.
For women, you have to almost beg for an EKG. So I think that we just need to remember that this is the number one killer of men and women, and especially for young women who present with a myocardial infarction are more likely to die. And we have delays in recognition. So we must be thinking about heart disease. I do think though your point is well taken that they might present differently in their pathophysiology. And that is true. And I think that's what's led our community in the past to describe people who even had positive troponins presented with EKG changes, the classic symptoms, and then they would find no obstructive coronary disease. And they'd say, oh, well, that was a false positive, or that stress test was abnormal, but we didn't find disease. That was a false positive. And I think we created within the medical community in general that somehow, you know, if you don't have an obstructive lesion, you don't have heart disease. And that's something we changed in the chest pain guidelines. We actually define coronary disease as both obstructive and non-obstructive coronary disease, because especially for women, it is much more common to see non-obstructive coronary disease as well as other pathophysiology of ischemia.
Now, one of those I was very much looking forward to talking to you about, because every time for the last three times I've been on service, I've admitted a woman and a young woman with a SCAD and with a spontaneous coronary artery dissection. Gosh, what a challenging, you know, diagnosis that is for both the heart team, as the podcast is called, as it is for the patients and their families about, you know, why and what does this mean and what to do. It's an interesting contrast to our talking about ways in which women are presenting the same and need the same kind of preventive treatments and guideline-directed management. But then we also need attention on the scenarios where it is unique and where something else is going on. And so, you know, I'd love your thoughts about where you think we are with SCAD and in terms of, you know, the unresolved questions and, you know, are we finding more because we're looking for it? And what do you think are some of the best ways we might explain and account for the, you know, this kind of presentation?
Yeah, I think, you know, spontaneous coronary artery dissection is something we're seeing more and more and recognizing more and more, and definitely has a female predominance. So I think that, you know, we're still at the earliest stages of understanding this disease process. I think, you know, we've had two large registries, one in Canada and one in the United States, I think, that have taught us the most about this. And I think that, you know, we're still learning though. You know, for years, even with SCAD, we were giving all these patients statin therapy, for example, and throwing everything at them just like they had had a myocardial infarction, because they had a myocardial infarction. We just didn't know what to do with them. And now we're learning that this is a very different disease process, and it's going to likely require different treatment. And even in the follow-up, I mean, this is such a challenging disease state, because, you know, in contrast with other forms of ischemic heart disease, we're usually telling people to exercise, and here we're giving them different exercise recommendations. And even that we're learning about, because Dr. Saw's group in British Columbia has been studying the effect of cardiac rehab and a specific cardiac rehab for SCAD patients. And I think, you know, learning from that is going to help all of us. I think a lot of us are trying to incorporate what they are doing into our own clinical setting, because the reality is for a lot of these patients, they're scared to exercise, and it's a hard even for them to live. There's a lot of anxiety after they get this diagnosis, because, you know, they can tell that most people don't know what's going well. Almost, we don't know what is going to bring on the next episode. We don't know if this is a one and done or if this is going to be multiple times in their life. And we don't entirely know if our medications that we're using are ideal for them. So I think that SCAD is still a lot more learning we have to go, but fortunately we do have these really wonderful registries that are teaching us a lot.
Yeah. Hard for those patients to come in to you know, not get an intervention, and which, you know, is a relief to patients very often to feel like something was done, and then to not necessarily get the, you know, all the therapies that we feel good about sending people home on. in terms of preventing another episode. And we, you know, leave so many open-ended questions. And then we say, now, you know, go home and sit at home and feel okay as you run after your little kids. And you don't have to think that you're having another episode when in fact, of course, they do have to. And it's, you know, obviously very stressful, very anxiety provoking. This, you know, the last patient I had had a history of migraines and ADD and was on meds for those that we wanted to, you know, move her away from, mm-hmm. Out of concerns for them, maybe, you know, being in a wrong direction. It was incredibly challenging. I know when she went home, I said, this patient will be back because she'll have a hard time sorting it out, as will we. And sure enough, you know, she was back a couple weeks later, fortunately with not another episode of SCAD, but it's just, I think really highlights the challenge, and we really do need to know more. And I think the push for that is really necessary in terms of the future of research.
So Martha, tell us, walk us through then the creation of specialized women's health clinics, the history around that, and where you think the future is. You're obviously at a place where you're at the cutting edge, working with wonderful people. And what do you see as the next 5 years over at Cedars doing tackling this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the origin of women's heart centers came from, of course, the early data showing that, you know, there was increased mortality in women from cardiovascular disease and lack of use of our, you know, guideline-directed therapy toward women. And as we were learning more and more about women, we realized that it was becoming a bit of a field of its own. Do I think in maybe 20 years that we will need it to be so specialized? I hope not. I hope by then we've taught everyone about both sexes. But right now, when the data is emerging and we know that not everyone is on top of, you know, it's just the same way. I can't keep up on top of every literature out there in our field. It's growing fast and furiously for all of us. That right now we feel like this is, you know, we need to focus for these specific sex-specific issues that we're learning a lot about. I think every women's heart center has been a little bit different in their focus based on the expertise that they have, you know, at their site. If they, you know, some places will almost exclusively focus on Anoka and Minoka, just because they have the expertise, they have the cath lab, they have partners, they have people from an imaging side. But some are more diffuse than that. Some will focus on all aspects related to sex differences, including cardio-obstetrics, following those patients. Some are doing research at the same time. And some are more of a marketing tool, but to at least let women know, we know that you exist. We're focused on women's differences in our group, and we'll find you the right place for your heart. And I think none of these are wrong how people approach them. But I do think that it has, for the big women's heart centers across the United States and Canada, especially, and I'd say Europe only has a handful. So it's hard for me to use them as an example. But I think in Canada and the United States, we do have some really strong women's heart centers that have also been leading in terms of the research that has come out of these programs. And I think it's also created a good research collaboration across the country, in the United States especially. For example, the Warrior study that's looking at non-obstructive coronary disease in women, this is across the country. There's so many sites that are enrolling women into this, and being able to be part of a trial trying to figure out medical therapy use versus usual care in Anoka patients. And for the HARP study, similarly, they're a cross-country collaboration. So I think it's also allowed us an opportunity to take our patients and offer them the chance to be involved in research. I think, you know, at my own center, again, I'm very fortunate to be here. I did, in the past, I had started my own women's heart centers at the places I was at, but I always used to use the Barbara Streisand Women's Heart Center as, you know, sort of the place that everyone maybe aspired to make their women's heart center be. We're certainly lucky. We have a lot of philanthropic support to make our mission possible. And that allows us to do both great patient care, great education within the community, research as well, and really encompass many areas of women and cardiovascular disease that I think allow us to do a lot of different projects. So I think that, you know, we invite people that want to start Women's Heart Centers to come here and look at how we're doing it, how our team exists and the different things that we do. And I think people will always take bits and pieces of what they see here and do. We also offer a fellowship. So we have three fellowships in the Women's Heart Center per year. And a lot of our former fellows have gone and created their own programs, including in Canada, but across the United States. So I think that we're also thinking about the next generation and not even that, just creating what we need right now for our cardiology community.
Do you think as part of the rationale for developing these centers that the residents who are passing through these institutions and the fellows in cardiology who are passing through these institutions but not specializing in this area, do you think they come out with a broader perspective? And maybe that's a rationale for institutions to say, well, at the moment we need these kinds of centers, not only because we advance knowledge and it's an important area, but also because we'll have an impact on the trainees who at least get exposed, you know, to these issues and concepts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely think that they are getting exposed, and I think we need to do better. I think at different places, I've seen different things where sometimes fellows and residents and medical students, it's an elective if they're interested. I think we need to be a core component of education. It's 52% of the population. Everyone, even in our general cardiology fellowship, should rotate in these clinics so that they learn about these things and that they take this knowledge with them. Because like I said, my goal one day is that we don't have these women's heart centers because everyone knows how to take care of men and women, right, and they understand these differences. But I also believe it means embedding us in medical schools. And I've been at medical schools where they've told us that we, you know, they didn't want to talk on women and heart disease, but they said that could be a special talk for an interest group. Yeah. And I think that to me was very shocking. And I think we really need to be embedding sex differences. And I'm not just saying about heart disease. I actually think in every organ system, when they're going through it, people should talk about what's similar and what's different. I'm sure there's differences in other diseases. I only know the cardiovascular system. But I'm sure that everyone would say that there's differences. And I think that we need to be emphasizing that from medical school onward.
Well, this has been wonderful. This concludes our episode today. Martha, thank you so much for your time and insights. We'll certainly have you back in the future, maybe many times, be member of our heart team. I want to thank Jorge Plotsky for helping our discussion today, as usual. For more cardiovascular news and expert insights and other episodes of the Heart Team, please visit hcplive.com. We thank you for tuning in to the Heart Team, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.